Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. The right to be blind without being disabled. That's the goal of Braille Without Borders, an international development organization which creates training programs and Braille book printing houses for blind and visually impaired people. Without Borders means BWB can work anywhere in the world and at the same time doesn't want to set any borders for those who can't see. The founders of Braille Without Borders are Paul Cronenberg and Sabria Ten Berken, my guest today. Born in Cologne, Germany, Sabria lost her sight when she was 12. Well, that didn't cramp her style. She eventually enrolled at Bonn University, where her coursework was eclectic, to say the least. She studied Central Asian sciences, learned Mongolian and modern Chinese, also studied modern and classical Tibetan, along with sociology and philosophy. In 1997, while traveling in the TAR, or Tibetan Autonomous Region, Sabria discovered those with visual disabilities were ostracized, children neglected, forced to beg for money. To the Buddhist majority, blindness is seen as a punishment for something one has done in his or her previous life. The situation had quite an impact on Sabria, and she wanted to make changes. It was on that trip that she met Paul Cronenberg, a Dutch engineer. She shared with him her idea, a way to provide training for blind and visually impaired Tibetans. The pair joined forces and created what eventually became Braille Without Borders. In 2005, Sabria co-founded Kantari, an institute for social visionaries. It encourages and fosters those from all over the globe who, like her, have a passion, a dream, a goal to make the world a better place. It's based in Kerala in south of India. Sabria's work has been duly recognized. She was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2005. In 2011, she was cited by the government of China as one of the 15 most influential overseas experts over the past 30 years in the country. Sabria is also the author of My Path Leads to Tibet, a bestseller that's been translated into 14 languages. Let's not waste any more time, and let's meet the amazing and inspiring Sabria Ten Berken. What an honor and a privilege to meet you.
Thank you very much.
I want to travel back in time to Cologne, Germany. You're 12 years old. You lose your eyesight. What happened?
Well, I started to lose my eyesight with 9 already, and it was very, very gradual. So it started first with not being able to see colors anymore, and then faces, and people start to tease me. And I think this was affecting me even more than losing the sight. And with the age of 12, I decided I am now blind and I have to embrace blindness. I should not whine anymore about things that I could not do, but I have to concentrate on the possibilities instead of the disabilities.
But did you have an illness? Did this just come upon you? I mean, it had to have been, even though it started at 9 and then you lost your sight completely at 12, I mean, it's still a shock.
Well, for my parents, it was not a shock. They knew that I would become blind with, starting puberty. The doctors, they told them that it's RP, or it's a special form of RP, which is retinitis pigmentosa. So for them, it was clear that at one point I would turn blind. For me, it was not clear because my parents didn't tell me necessarily. And they didn't want to shock me, or they didn't want to create fear in me, because I must say I was terrified of being blind. I felt that I didn't want to be in darkness. I knew, of course, or not I knew, but I thought it would be totally dark. And a great thing about being blind, or at least for many, many blind people I met, they would say exactly the same thing. The great thing is it doesn't really become dark, despite the fact that I don't see anything, even no light, no darkness. The world surrounding me became actually much, much more colorful. Because I could imagine everything.
Is this a disease that's hereditary? Did anybody in your family have this?
Nobody.
RP?
Nobody in my family had it. Therefore, nobody really knows where it came from. It could be a mutation. It could be rubella. It could be a gas explosion in this time when my eyes were developing. So nobody really understands why I have this.
Now, do you have other siblings?
Yes, I have an older brother. He's perfectly sighted. All my relatives are very, very sighted and very visual. And I'm visual as well, actually.
But aside from saying that you were frightened, were you angry?
I was angry. I was very, very angry, and I was very temperamental. I was mainly angry because of the people surrounding me, because the people, they treated me like a little kid, and they didn't take me seriously anymore. Hmm. And before, I had a lot of friends, and suddenly I didn't have any friends anymore, and this really got on my nerves.
People didn't know what to do with you.
Exactly, exactly. And they didn't know how to talk to me, they didn't know what I could do, what I could not do. And of course, in Germany, people have this very weird sense of what it is to be blind, so they know exactly what is good for you and what is not good for
you. Or so they think.
Exactly, that's what they think. And I was really rebellious against that. I didn't like it at all.
So did you not go to a special school or see specialists, or did you create your own world for yourself that you didn't need help from professionals?
Well, I went to a special school later. I was at first at a regular school. I was at a Waldorf school. And it didn't really work out anymore because I couldn't read what's on the blackboard.
Of course.
And things like that. And then when I decided, yes, now I have to embrace blindness, I went to a very, very good school for the blind. I mean, it's a school that has a lot of focus on academia, and it's a school which is very sports oriented. So we learned, for example, we had whitewater kayaking, we had horses, we had skiing, downhill skiing, cross-country skiing.
So no one was going to treat you like you were an invalid.
Exactly. No, they're actually in the opposite. They would give us all the techniques and the tools, and we had to learn them, and of course we had to become professional in these techniques and in the tools. And then they said, and then the world is open for you, so you have to discover your world. And that was a great attitude, mm-hmm. from the teachers towards us, you know. So they expected a lot from us
to be proactive and
absolutely.
To take your life into your own hands.
Absolutely.
Except that there's a quote that you had said that you felt like you came from the margins of society.
Yes, I felt very, very alienated. And at first I felt alienated in a negative way. And I must say, later I accepted it. And I said, well, I was an alien, I will be an alien, I am an alien. But now, what can I do to make the alienation in a positive way? So, first of all, I wanted to get out of Germany and wanted to test myself, probably also. You know, I wanted to have adventure, I wanted to, discover new worlds, I wanted to learn languages and write about it and contribute to society. And that's why I decided to study Tibetology.
Yeah, that was my next question. You go to Bonn University, and oh my God, as I tick these things off, modern Chinese, Mongolian, Central Asian studies. How'd you pick that curriculum?
Well, my favorite subjects were probably more philosophy and sociology, which was, in addition to all these languages. Well, Tibetology, I studied not really because of a lot of other people's, they have their reasons for studying Tibetology because they want to be in a monastery, they want mm-hmm. to look at all these ancient texts. For me, that was not very important. For me, it was the language. I wanted to learn the language because when you're traveling on your own, you have to master the language. You have to be able to talk because my lip reading, my
non-verbal
communication is not very advanced. You know.
Right.
So therefore I studied all these different languages: Chinese, Mongolian, and Tibetan, mainly Tibetan. During my studies, I had to actually create a braille system for the Tibetan language because I needed some kind of system in which I could write down my vocabularies and my grammatical sentences.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied system, the Tibetan system, which is based on the Sanskrit system, and I created a braille system which is one-on-one translatable. And later somebody found out that this braille system is not existent in Tibet yet. So I decided to go to Tibet to show it to the education department and to show it also to blind people in Tibet, and see what I could do with
it. So that's what propelled you to
exactly.
make that first journey to
yes,
Tibet.
Yes,
which, by the way, you made on horseback?
Partly, yes, on horseback. That has a good reason, because when I travel in a car and there is a window between me and the outside world, it's very difficult to really find out what's going on outside. You know, I cannot listen to the rivers and to the wind and to what is all out there. So when I'm on a horse, of course, the the surrounding is touching me, basically, you know. So it's very, very, I can smell the things, I can listen to all the bells of the yaks, and this is how I create pictures in my mind of Tibet.
Now, how old were you when you made this amazing journey?
I was 26 years old when I started to venture.
And that was the first time you left the country?
No. I lived in America before for one year in Philadelphia for, yeah, as an exchange student. I was 16. I came to America. Yeah.
So your wanderlust goes back a bunch of years.
Yes,
before
yes.
the trip to Tibet.
Oh, yeah. I love to travel. I traveled a lot on my own, mainly also because it's really annoying when you're traveling as a blind person with a sighted person. People always tend to talk to the sighted person. And it really happens still when Paul and I travel together, that people just talk to him. And and it really annoys me because, I mean, I have a mouth, I have a brain, but they still say, does she want sugar in her coffee?
Oh,
you
gosh.
Know?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, this is, and this was something that I didn't like back then either. And I thought, well, I need to be able to travel on my own and to experience the landscapes, the people surrounding me, the animals, all the challenges. I was very adventurous. The first motivation was not really a social one, I must admit. But the first motivation was mainly adventure and the escape of a very controlled and very, very homey kind of atmosphere, which Germany gives.
Homey, or do you mean safe?
A home-like feeling, sitting safe in your sofa and being pampered, basically.
Okay. What kind of a relationship did you have with your parents? Were they very encouraging for you to go out on your own, to strike out on your
Absolutely.
Own?
Absolutely. My mother was an adventurer herself, so she traveled a lot through Turkey when she was a student. She traveled actually dressed as a man because she had to measure mosques. So that was in the very beginning of the
60s. So that's hereditary for you.
You've got some
of your mom's genes.
Yes, definitely. So they were all, I mean, they're artists, they're very creative thinkers, very creative people. And my brother is also an artist. So, I do believe that something came over to me.
So here you are, you're in the Himalayas or the Himalayas, and you're traveling with a group, I'm guessing, right? You weren't by yourself.
Yes. Well, I came to Tibet by myself.
You traveled from Germany.
To Tibet by myself.
By yourself.
And of course, when you're traveling on your own, you meet a lot of people, you know, and this is the great thing. And then I really wanted to venture through the countryside, through the remote areas, because I wanted to meet people in the remote areas where cars could not come. And then I decided to put together a small caravan. And there were actually horse riders who went to the countryside where I wanted to go. And I heard that a lot of blind people are there because of vitamin A deficiency. So we put a caravan together and we followed these horse people who wanted to go there anyway. And then, we met a lot of families with older blind people and with younger blind people. Some people thought that I'm a doctor and they wanted to get cure from me. But we also met some people with children. And that was actually, at first, it was very, very depressing, I really must say. Because the children, they were not taken seriously. Kids were tied to a bed or hidden in dark rooms. Mainly because the parents were ashamed.
Because they were blind.
Because they were blind. And then later I found out that blindness is really seen as a punishment for something you had done in your past life.
Yeah. So this obviously is so impactful on you. And you're thinking, I got to do something.
Well, actually, at first I thought, I cannot do anything. Who am I to come here as a long nose and telling the people to change. And then I met a little boy, 8 years old, Tenzin. He's now a grown-up man. And he said, I heard you are blind. I am blind too. And this was the only person that actually said it with a sense of pride. And that gave me the courage to do something, because I found out that this little boy, he didn't go to school. While the other kids went to school, he heard the yaks and the goats in the mountains. Hmm. And that was very, very interesting to me, because he had a sense in life. He had a meaning in life, and he was not ashamed at all. And this was the point where I said, well, I wanted to start not really exactly a school for the blind, but much more a springboard for them, you know, to give them energy, to give them power, to give them the understanding that we don't have to be ashamed. And where they get all the knowledge, the mobility training, the knowledge in Braille, in English Braille, Chinese Braille, Tibetan Braille, and everything they need to learn to actually take their lives in their own hands and jump back into society and say, yes, I'm blind, so what?
So they had, until you entered their lives for the most part, they had no resources.
Exactly, yeah. They were absolutely ostracized. They were outcast of society. Some of them were not outcast of society, but were basically sitting on the streets and begging. And some were really hidden away. They would never, ever see other people or meet other people.
So how do you start that? So you become overwhelmed by this, and then you think, I want to do something. After you get over this, who the hell am I to think that I can do something? So you move to that next phase. How do you even get this thing off the ground? How do you start?
Well, I knew that I couldn't pass the government. I went to the government without an appointment, actually. I went in there with my cane. And I think they were a bit shocked, you know, because I came a long nose, a blind person. They probably never saw a blind person before, or at least not a confident one. And in my really bad Tibetan and a little bit of Chinese, I tried to explain what I wanted to do. And somehow it made an impression on them. Or they wanted me out of the office.
Or that they were afraid of you.
Yeah, that could also be. So somehow they gave me all the contracts that I needed to do some fundraising in Germany with all the nice red stamps that I needed. And the next thing was I met Paul. And Paul was the only foreigner that didn't think that I was
crazy.
Totally crazy. Yeah, exactly. And so he was interested in what I was doing, and he was just saying, like, hey, come on, let me know what you're doing, and maybe I can help you in one or the other way. And of course, what I didn't know was that he would actually quit his job, you know, if I just had to call him. And mm-hmm. I did so. I called him and I just said, well, I'm leaving next week and I just want to say goodbye. That was, I think, about 8 months later.
You were in Tibet for 8 months?
No, I was in Germany for 8 months to do fundraising and
right.
to talk to the German government and to get the startup funding for this project.
How long were you in Tibet that first time?
First time, 3 months.
Okay, and then that's when you went back to Germany to
exactly.
get this project off the ground.
Yeah, and I quit university, by the way. I jumped out because I had the feeling, well, I studied because I wanted to do something like this. And I felt, this is now the time. Why do I need a university degree if I just have the project on my plate
exactly.
that I wanted to do? And then I called him and he didn't say anything. And I said, well, Paul, don't cry. Just wish me good luck. And yeah, and then he came with me. He said, well, I quit my job and I come with you. So sometimes it's good to quit some things, to jump out of a system, to do something new.
Absolutely. And he was, I guess he was smitten by the whole idea. Not overwhelmed by it, I gather.
No, he was not overwhelmed, but he was adventurous enough to see the potential of it.
So how hard was it to collect money, to raise money for this project?
It was difficult. And let me tell you why. It was mainly difficult because people didn't believe that we could do it. It's very, very difficult to start something and people would always say, you are too small.
Hmm.
Stay on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Don't grab for the stars. You know, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people knew that I was not
a
social. I was not a social pedagogue. So why are you going to dare to start a school
mm-hmm.
for the blind?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, Paul didn't know anything about blind people. So who was he? You know, so and
so these, there was a little nervousness or not nervousness. That's not
no, that they would not trust
trust
us.
Right?
Yeah,
their
they
lack
would
of
not
trust,
trust us. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very often with social visionaries or with people who have a vision, who have a dream. It's very often that they hear this. You know, come on, stay on the ground, don't grab for the stars. Mm-hmm. This is what mm-hmm. we hear normally.
You were able to amass a certain amount of money to get this off the ground?
Yes, here and there and slowly but steadily. And of course, because we are, we can talk a lot, but we are actually doing what we are saying. And that gives the trust.
You put your money where your mouth is.
Okay. That's an interesting saying.
Yeah, that's a real, more of a New Yorkie kind of
okay.
saying, I guess. So was it just the two of you who did Braille Without Borders?
Yes.
Or how did you come up with that name?
Yeah, well, actually, of course, Braille is obvious. For us, Braille is the doorway to the world, basically. For mm-hmm. me, at least, it was. And it is the form of literacy. It's not necessarily an audiobook or a daisy book or something like that. That's a great thing to have, you know. But Braille is the substitute for actual reading with your eyes. And therefore, Braille is a very, very important method or important tool for blind people to get literacy. But Without Borders, of course, means on one hand that we can work wherever. It doesn't have to be only in Tibet. But Without Borders means much, much more that we don't want to set borders, the inner borders, the boundaries, the limits to blind people, and mm-hmm. that we just have to empower them to see the beauty of blindness, you know, not just to whine about all the things that they cannot do.
You've got this money, you're back in Tibet. Was it difficult to get this project off the ground once you were there?
Yes, it was very difficult because we had a lot of challenges. In the beginning, there's always a little bit of luck in the beginning. Otherwise, you wouldn't start. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we, for example, we were host in an orphanage, and it seemed to be great, you know, and because we got all the rooms for free and we got all the support we needed. But actually, we found out that the principal of the orphanage, he wanted to get much, much more out of us. You
money
know?
Wise?
So, money wise, mm-hmm. yeah. And partly Paul was working for the Red Cross, so I was alone very often. And so there was, for example, one very interesting thing. He was, he told me that he bought the furniture that I had requested for and paid for. And I never saw the furniture. And I said, well, where is the furniture? And he said, if you could see, you would see the furniture in the room.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, exactly. But we just don't know where the key is right now, you know?
So he's then, pulling the wool over your
exactly.
eyes.
Exactly. Then Paul came. And I said, Paul, can you just have a look in this room through the window? And he said, the room is empty. You know, and these things happened, and then we found out how he was treating our kids, and he was just using them because they were cute, you know, he just used them as a cute factor, mm-hmm. and we at a certain point we were thrown out of the building, and because we had a big mouth, so we were standing with six kids on the road, basically in the middle of the winter, and the winter was really freezing cold, and Paul was sick, and I had a lot to do to keep these kids safe with me, but they didn't want to go home either because they felt so familiar with us, and they felt that we were their new parents.
Sure.
In a way, you know, so they didn't want to leave us, and then luckily we found another place, which is actually it's a small it's called Podrang. It's a small, they call it palazzo, you know, or like a little palace, but mm-hmm. it's not really a palace. But it is belonging to the family of the 13th Dalai Lama. And they asked us to come in this school, and we felt so welcome and so warmly treated. And later they asked us, why don't you want to buy this house? And of course, we had no money. We had no money. But then at this time, I was writing my first book, My Path Leads to Tibet. And what was quite funny, I mean, we were so naive to say, this book is probably going to be a bestseller, you know? So we said, okay, let's have a contract with you that we pay in a half year. Because the book would come out in 3 months from that point. And then I thought maybe in a half year we get so much money that we could buy the house. And actually we paid 6 days late.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, that actually worked out the way you thought it
exactly.
was going
it
to?
Exactly. It became a bestseller.
Boy, there's a lot of luck on your side, too.
Yes, I must say. Normally, I don't really tell this to our students in India because this is something I would never do today, you know?
But with all
then,
your wisdom, yeah.
Exactly.
What year was that? What year are we talking about?
That was about 2000, the book came out, and we paid for the house in the winter of 2000.
Now, how did Braille Without Borders expand beyond Tibet?
Yeah, actually, the thing is that we saw that all our dreams were coming true in one or the other way, despite the fact that everybody would tell us it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
So and I said, well, of course it's possible. We just have to find the right way and we have to believe in our dream. And we said, so if it is possible to empower blind kids to run their own projects, because now our blind kids from the first and second generation are actually running this project in Tibet, why not training other blind people or people from the margins in general who have a social vision, why not training them in making their dreams come true, their social dreams come true? So we wanted to make out of this springboard for Tibetan children, you know, we wanted to create a global springboard for social visionaries from all around the world who come to a central place somewhere in this world. And we thought south of India is very central in this world.
I see
because,
where you're going with
because,
this.
Yeah, we have Africa on one side and Asia on the other side. And actually, south of India looks a little bit like a springboard if you look at the map. So we said we want to be somewhere central in the world and we want to create a center, a dream factory for people with a story, for people who have overcome adversity. It could be blind people, it can be war survivors, it can be people who are fighting against female genital mutilation, it could be women that are abused by society. It could be people who have overcome adversity but use this adversity as a source of strength and be motivated, intrinsically motivated to create their big dreams and then actually realize these big dreams.
You started your own UNICEF, didn't you?
Oh, maybe, yeah. I never thought of it that way. But in a way, it is a very small center and we are highly selective.
Do you award grants? Now, this is what Kantari is,
yeah.
Right? What's the definition of that?
Yeah, that's a very important question. Kantari is a very, very small but very spicy chili. And this chili is not only spicy, but it's medicinal as well. So it makes you very alert, much, much more alert than a coffee. And it purifies your blood and it lowers the blood pressure. So it's very healthy, actually. It's a very healthy chili. And the great thing is this chili grows in the backyards of society. It grows in the backyards of the Kerala, of Kerala's people. And it grows wild.
Mm-hmm.
So and it's exactly the symbol for our leaders, you know, or for our social visionaries who have fire in the belly, who have spice in their action, and who have the guts to challenge the status quo, but also the possibilities and the energy to come up with healthy medicinal solutions. And they're all from the margins of society, just like the Kantari. And we want to actually create a new paradigm of leadership with this word Kantari, and people already apply by saying, I am a Kantari, which is great.
That is great. So they come to the south of India where they are, and I'm using the word in quotes, trained through your organization. You do award grants. How does it?
Yes.
Yes. And where does your money come from?
Well, we are doing fundraising. Right now, we are also here in America to do fundraising and to do a book promotion. Maybe I can tell you a little bit about that also.
Go ahead.
So we are mainly doing fundraising and trying to convince the people that whatever they give to, for example, if they give a scholarship, it's not a scholarship for an individual. It's a scholarship. It's an investment in one project, in a future project for ethical social change. And that's, of course, a big, big difference to any other institute in the world or to many other institutes in the world, where it's normally about this individual person. But here it's about projects. It's about social projects, long-lasting social projects that are motivated by an intrinsic interest, actually an existential interest. So, for example, we have people like albinos from East Africa. I don't know if you heard of that. Albinos in East Africa are very much endangered to be killed by witch doctors who hunt albinos down because they want to cut off their body parts and sell them on the black market, because body parts of albinos are supposed to be good luck charms, and they make potions out of it. It's horrible. It's really, really horrible. And we had albinos in our project, and they are empowered, you know, to do public speaking, to do project management, campaigning, fundraising, and really to run their own campaigns against these witch doctors and against the politicians who have fingers of albinos in their pockets to be reselected.
Aye. So yeah. There isn't an area that you don't touch?
No, actually not. Well, we are really interested in social change agents, in Kantaris, who have the guts to go against conventions, harmful conventions.
So what's tomorrow going to bring for you?
Tomorrow, we are very busy with this project, with this Kantari project, and we just want to create another Kantari in Africa, because most of our applicants, they are from Africa. And so we thought, why not having one Kantari center in Asia, one in Africa, and maybe in the future one in South America? Who knows?
Wow. There's no stopping you, is there, Sabrié?
Not really. No, no.
You're a ballsy broad, you know.
But the great thing is you get so much energy from the people we are meeting, you know. And just in this trip, we are going around from one city to another, also with this author from a book who wrote about our both projects. She was there as a sighted person being terrified about blindness, and she was actually sent by Oprah Winfrey to Tibet to meet me, and she didn't want to meet me. Actually, she thought, why do I have to meet this blind woman? I don't want to meet blind people. So then she met not only me, but she met a lot of our kids in Tibet, and she was actually blindfolded by these kids, and they're shameless, you know. They take her, and despite the fact that she was terrified, they would take her through Lhasa, through back then a very chaotic city, and they showed her Lhasa under the blindfold, where she was never before. So she actually got to know
experience
Lhasa.
What that's like,
exactly.
Too.
And then she came to, she was very inspired. She came then later as a teacher to Kerala, to Kantari, and she met these most extraordinary people, you know, very charismatic people. And she wrote about them, and she wrote about their stories. And I must say, it's sometimes heartbreaking to read these stories, but most of the time we were laughing so hard when we read this book. Actually, I was a bit afraid to read her book. It's, by the way, it's called For the Benefit of Those Who See. But I must say, it's also for the benefit of those who don't see, you know? And it's definitely for the benefit of those who are open to change their mind, whether they are sighted or blind. And the greatest thing is really how she describes these blind people and how she describes herself in the interaction with blind people. And it's really hilarious. And I can very, very much promote this book, because it's not mine. I don't have anything out of it, despite the fact that people really learn about what we are doing and maybe are interested then to apply to our Kantari Center, either as a participant, as a social visionaries who want to do social change, or as a catalyst who want to come, like Rosemary Mahoney, the author, and to teach in Kantari.
Well, I just have to say this. Unlike Rosemary, I really did want to meet you, and I am so thrilled and excited to have met you. You lit a fire under my behind. You're an amazing woman, and I only wish you more. You and Paul and your whole organization and all the people who work with you, just so much continued success. The world needs more of you, clearly.
Thank you.
It's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Great.
Join us for another edition of The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The the 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.